From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Let's go back to, the 20th century, back to the time when Pan Am and IBM promised the future, and when a filmmaker named Stanley Kubrick said he wanted to do something that had never been done before, make a good science fiction movie. It seems hard to believe, but it's now 50 years after the debut of his film 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it has been lovingly brought back to life. I don't want to say restored, for a limited 70mm run, and it'll be premiering at the Cannes Film Festival this week by my guest, Christopher Nolan. It's always good to have you here. Good to have you back.
Oh, good to be here.
Tell me about the aural impact of 2001, because it's not only a massive visual scape, it's also a massive audio scape, isn't it?
It's a massive audio scape. I mean, as you referred to in your introduction, we're calling this the unrestored version, because what we've done is we've gone back to the original elements. And so photochemical for the picture, 70mm photochemical prints. And then on the sound, we went back to the six-track master that was originally put on the 70mm prints, and we transferred it onto a format that we can play in today's theaters. And that mix is truly astounding. I mean, we were all shocked listening to it. There are sonic peaks in there that, I mean, I like to say I like loud films. I like to mix my films loud, but there are sonic peaks in that mix of 2001 that are just more daring than anything I would do. And it was an interesting thing. You know, we sat there and we looked at each other and we sort of, you know, you have that instant of like, well, can we do this? I mean, and then you say, well, this is the way he mixed the film. This is how people were meant to experience it. And so that's exactly how we've done it. We've run it a couple of different theaters and listened to it. And I have to say, when you hear it in context and when you see it and hear it with that 70mm picture, with that six-track sound, you understand those sonic peaks. You understand in context why he's done that. It rattles you at the right moments. It expands the world of the film. It takes you through the Stargate, you know, this extraordinary sounds, this extraordinary use of music. It's like anything that had been done before. And the really fun thing about, you know, working on it and putting it out again is to realize how radical it still is 50 years after it was made.
How do you mean?
Well, things like the way in which that sound was mixed, but also the storytelling, the absolute simplicity of the storytelling. Yes, the film's somewhat elusive or oblique in terms of its specific meaning. It's relying on an experience for the audience. It's relying on the idea of pure cinema, pure image and sound, taking you on some narrative journey. But the simplicity with which it does that and the confidence with which it does that, the authority that the film has, is absolutely fresh.
I've always thought, too, the fascinating thing about that film is that it's basically impossible to describe it to anybody.
Yeah. It doesn't work in words. It doesn't work in other forms. I mean, it's worth noting, you know, there's a great novel that was written of it by Arthur C. Clarke, who is Kubrick's collaborator on the screenplay. But the novel is completely different in its effects. It's sort of, you know, in some senses it explains what's in the film a bit more literally, perhaps. But really it's a different experience, and it's very much Clarke's version of science fiction, if you like. 2001 is an experience that is purely cinematic, and which is why I think for a lot of filmmakers, it's like myself, it's sort of always stands up there as the kind of pinnacle of what movies can be. It shows you that movies can be anything. It's not so much that it breaks the rules. It just doesn't even acknowledge that there are any rules. It just presents this completely unique and compelling experience that you can have in a movie theater.
That's something I was just going to ask you about, because what I've always felt about is that it really creates a new film grammar in that way, that it starts off almost like an old-fashioned stage show. You get the overture before the movie starts. Mm. So you're introduced to this world. It's almost in that respect kind of a warm bath. And then the length of that music, you realize it takes its time.
Yeah.
And if you're seeing it for the first time, you really have to give into it, because you're not going to be satisfied by any kind of conventional narrative convention, are you?
No, you're not. But you're going to have a narrative experience that's undeniable and universal. The extraordinary thing about the history of the film, what makes it, I think, unique, I mean, I can't think of other examples where They premiered the film in Washington and New York, and hundreds of people walked out, literally hundreds.
You should say that was a longer version, too.
It was a longer version, but it wasn't, let me put it this way, it wasn't different enough that it would excuse that people walked out of the film at the premiere. You don't generally walk out of a premiere, you know, it's like, come on, give the guy a chance, right? Come back after the intermission and see where it goes, you know. But people walked out. The early reviews were, and not even just the early reviews, I mean, Pauline Kael reviewed the film a year after it came out and said it was, I think, monumentally unimaginative or something was the phrase. You had a lot of feeling against this film, but right from the first day it started playing, there were lines around the block, and it was the number one film for 1968, box office-wise. And that's an incredible differential there between its sort of initial response and where it wound up on its initial release. I mean, film history is full of masterpieces that were not appreciated when they first came out and that over time came to be appreciated. And that wasn't really the dynamic with 2001. 2001 was more of a split between, in a sense, the establishment or established ways of thinking of films, and then newer, younger moviegoers looking for or recognizing this incredible shift, this paradigm shift in movie making for what it really is.
I would say, now I ask you this, if we can say about the great films, about great art, in fact, is that they satisfy an appetite that has not yet been identified.
Yeah.
And that's what this film did, and that's why there was such a generational, really, schism between its audience and those who were commenting on it.
There's always a tension in mainstream filmmaking, because 2001 is a mainstream film.
And made for a major studio.
Made for a major studio and the number one film of that year. I mean, it's playing in that arena. Kubrick was working within the studio system and within the arena of mainstream filmmaking. And there's always this tension in mainstream filmmaking between, I suppose you could reduce it to art and commerce, but the idea of fulfilling certain expectations so that there's a guarantee of entertainment for the audience, if you will, but then also giving them something new. And 2001 leans very heavily on the side of giving them something new, more heavily than any other films I can think of, really right back to, I suppose you'd really have to go back to Griffith, I think, for that kind of whole cloth reinvention of movies. Just, okay, movies can be this now. And what I found revisiting the film, and I've watched it dozens of times in the last couple months, you know, putting this together, and the thing that's really struck me is it offered a new vision of what films could be. It broke all the rules, or reinvented the rules, as you said. But it didn't establish a new rule set that was necessarily of much use to filmmakers following.
Which is why it wasn't really wildly imitated.
It's
in
not,
the interim. Usually when the film like that somehow is a bulwark of something different, in the couple of years after, you see a massive number of imitations, but that didn't happen.
Yeah, the only thing that you find in sort of post-2001 cinema is there is a preponderance in the sort of 10 years after it of sort of trippy endings to films, if you like. If you think of, like, I don't know, Altered States or, you know, Demon Seed or these kind of films where there's a sort of big trippy light show towards the end. It had that influence. I mean, Trumbull's Stargate sequence, you know, had that influence. But really, it isn't imitated much. You're right. And today, it seems as daring and as innovative as it did 50 years ago.
It's a treatment. We're talking about the film 2001 by not its director, but one of its lovers, the man responsible for bringing it back to theaters in 70mm, the way God and Stanley Kubrick had intended it, as Christopher Nolan. As we're talking about this, though, I wonder, because show business is such a place of imitation that calls for that so often, and that often becomes a kind of a loving homage to the filmmaker, that this film escaped that in that decade after. Why do you think that was?
Well, as we talk about it, what occurs to me is that the reason I think 2001 is Kubrick's masterpiece is because, for me, it's the film where his meticulous craftsmanship, his absolute devotion to extraordinarily, you know, disciplined, detailed focus on the technical issues of filmmaking. 2001 is the film where that actually is at the heart of the film. It's actually part of the main attraction. So these incredible visual effects that aren't just there to show off or whatever, they're actually very specifically the emotional heart of the story. So for me, when I see that revolving space station and the Strauss is playing, I have a very a very particularly emotional response to that image, even though in other hands it would just be a technical image, it would just be a visual effect. It's not just a visual effect, it's iconography that moves you. And that's what's at the center of the film. And so as we talk about it, I start to realize that to imitate that would be to have to engage in the kind of extraordinarily complex and difficult technical feat that really only he was capable of pulling off. In other words, people didn't imitate it because to get halfway there to that level of technical innovation and perfection just wouldn't work. And unlike today, where so many things are done, you know, on computer, they're software-based. So by definition, they can immediately be imitated by other people because they essentially just buy the same software. So once they've seen the artistic or technical innovation of a particular film, they can then buy that for themselves. 2001 was made with models, with motion control, pre-computers, really. I mean, all kinds of extraordinarily difficult things. It took years to make.
Not to mention enormously innovative sets.
Enormously innovative sets, the way in which the sets were engineered to move and so forth. Nothing in 2001 was done the easy way. It was done the right way. It was done with this implacable, you know, pursuit of perfection that Kubrick had. And so I think in that sense, it's impossible to truly imitate. And so what you find is the influence is there, but in more interesting ways. So when you look at George Lucas's first Star Wars in 1977, you see a massive influence of 2001, but he's taken it in this much more kinetic sort of pop direction. But the miniature photography and the feeling of reality to science fiction, is something that George Lucas was clearly very inspired by 2001.
I think a big part of it, too, and I think you're getting at it, is that it's so much of it works in so many subliminal ways, and that aural, that soundscape, for example, to go back to that, it's my key connection to the film, because I just feel like it's a film you can actually, and I've done this, sit for large sections of it with your eyes closed and still have an experience that feels unique to a movie theater.
You shouldn't be sleeping during screenings.
I didn't say sleeping. I said I've seen it enough that I can risk that.
No, definitely. No, you're absolutely right. It's always underestimated is the use of music in the film. And when I say underestimated, I just mean that because it's existing cues.
And that was a radical thing too, which you say, by the way.
It was a radical thing to do. But not only was it a radical thing to do, it's also something that hasn't really been followed either, in truth. I mean, there are a lot of films with source music. There are a lot of films that use songs, for example. But the idea of using classical music to score a science fiction film set in the future, using the music of the past, was utterly radical. And it's also what the music is. So particularly the Blue Danube Waltz. I mean, it's such an unlikely choice for the subject matter. And we were talking about the Michael Benson book before we went on air, and he describes, you know, people hearing that music sort of playing out from the edit suite and thinking that, you know, Kubrick had gone mad. He's saying, how could he possibly be, you know, and was it a kitsch thing or this or that? But of course, the effect has now been that, firstly, those pieces of music are indelibly associated with 2001 now, you know, Also Sprach Zarathustra and the Blue Danube. And beyond that, the music never dates, the music never ages. So usually with science fiction particularly, things like the music that's used, whether you're looking at, I don't know, Forbidden Planet, you know, the music tends to very much date the film. But of course, what Kubrick had figured out is that by using, as it were, old music, using music that had nothing to do with the time in which the film was set, he was creating something that had the potential to be timeless.
We're going to take a break. My guest who's accusing me of sleeping during a classic is Christopher Nolan. We're talking about the film 2001 as the treatment is more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. I'm trying to stay awake talking about the film 2001 with my guest Christopher Nolan, who's been in charge of bringing the film back the way it should be seen to theaters in 70mm. He supervised, how best to put this, placing the film back in the kinds of technical places it belongs. One of the things I want to say, just to get back, since we are on radio here and this is the way people get the show, is the daring of giving AI a human voice rather than trying to make it sound robotic. I mean, that's now literally the way AI works, but it was such a daring move then. I mean, that's another of the disconnects that makes the film feel
it,
so.
It was incredibly daring. And 2001's relationship with the future has changed and ebbed and flowed over time in terms of its relevance. And so when I first showed my kids this film, like I would say 10 years ago, one of their questions to me back then was, why does the computer talk? Because to them, a computer was, it's a tool, you know, it was a tool, not an entity. It was like a screwdriver, you know, or a typewriter, rather than, you know, what we had thought of as a sort of conscious entity. Now, its version of AI is eerily prescient. I mean, we're dealing with, from Siri onwards, it's all about AI that tries to communicate with a human voice. And so the film right now, I think, feels more relevant and more prescient in its attitude towards artificial intelligence than probably it ever has, including when it first came out. And that's the incredible thing about the simplicity of the film and the elemental tools, really, that Kubrick used to get his point across. They age incredibly well. There is an ebb and flow with the future. I mean, I remember as a kid watching the film a little later, you know, in my early 20s, and things like the video conference calls and things, they seemed a bit old hat. It's like, well, are we really going to have, you know, video chats in the future and all the rest? And of course, now that FaceTime has come along and they have iPads in the film. I mean, they literally have a thing that's clearly the inspiration for the iPad. And so it's very much come back into focus as an incredibly accurate predictor of technology and how we're going to have problems relating with technology.
But as much as he was the master of all these details, as Michael Benson points out in that really good book, he was also a collaborator. And he talks about his Kubrick's conversations with Gary Lockwood about changing some very specific things. And this gets back to the AI, when Lockwood came up with the idea of he and Carol DeLay having the discussion away from the ship and the computer reads their lips. I mean, that was also a sign, too, that in addition to supervising all these details, he kept his eyes and ears open to anything that would make the film better.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's a huge part of his skill as a filmmaker. I mean, the thing about Kubrick is, I think he's, you know, arguably the greatest director who has ever worked. And part of the job of being a director is getting the right people around you and listening to them, not doing everything they say, but, you know, sifting through it, picking and choosing. And from everything that I've read about the making of 2001 and indeed his other films and talking to people who knew him and worked with him, he was ruthless in his pursuit of information from people or ideas from people. You know, he would demand
in his personal and professional life.
I think so. But professionally, very, very focused on the best solution to whatever narrative problem that he's looking at, wherever that might come from. And that's a huge part of being a filmmaker, and he was one of the smartest filmmakers he's ever been, so he would certainly have availed himself of the input of all of the experts he put around him. Because of the subject matter of 2001, he was genuinely surrounded by a lot of different experts in different fields, and they went out to the different companies like IBM and Pan Am and whoever, and sort of said to them, okay, well, what are your ideas for where things will be in the future and what might those technologies be? And they tried to base everything on the film on those kind of ideas. And so if you think about that, there was a real demand on the people around them and the people they were bringing into the fold to talk about the future, to come up with the goods and come up with interesting things.
It's interesting because one of the things I feel about 2001, and I wonder if this is one of the things that has impacted you because it's been present so much in the way you work, in the way you tell stories, is the idea at some point or another, something that feels like dream time is in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I took away from the very first time I saw 2001, when I was 7 years old, they re-released the film after Star Wars was such a hit in 1977. My dad took me to see it in Leicester Square on this huge screen, 70 mil. And part of that experience that I've always carried with me is this peculiar sense of, I suppose, timelessness or a lack of understanding of what the timescale you're watching of this experience was. You felt that the screen opened up and you went on a journey. And when the journey finished, it was difficult to really parse exactly what's the timescale of the film and so forth, particularly at the end. And 50 years on, we're probably okay to talk about spoilers. 2001. Actually, it's a pretty tough film to spoil, let's be honest.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, the entire ending with its elisions, you know, when you get through the Stargate and you get to that room and the way in which it takes these abstract leaps in time, they work in this incredibly intuitive way. And the audience feels the point. They feel the meaning. It gets back to what you were talking about earlier, which is, you know, this is pure cinema. This is not really something that could work as a radio play or as a book or anything else or television. It's this experience you're having that is collapsing time and expanding time in very innovative and you know, endlessly fascinating ways.
It's the treatment, my guest, who's determined to give away all of 2001, is Christopher Nolan. He's been involved in basically rebuilding the film and from its original elements. It'll be playing in 70 millimeter in a limited number of theaters around the country. We have to get back to this. We've talked about this any number of times since I've known you, but the primacy of film as a medium for you.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was one of the things that brought you to this, that you would do it and project it on film rather than using any sort of digital system for that.
Yes. I mean, I still work on film, on celluloid film, and I don't do a digital intermediate. I cut the negatives of my films and I present them that way, and I love doing it.
And why is that?
Well, really, celluloid film, the photochemical process, it's the best analogy for the way the eye sees that's been invented. So there's a depth to the color, there's a superiority, there's a resolution.
There's a depth to the blacks that you still can't get in digital.
The blacks, the contrast, everything. I mean, there are all kinds of things that digital technology can't duplicate. It can do its own version of it, and there are a lot of filmmakers who respond very well to that and really enjoy that version of imaging, but it's different. And so when you start looking at film history, when you start looking at 2001 and the experience that I was able to have watching it on an early re-release, to be able to give audiences today that same analog experience, I think is very important. And one of the things that this touches on is film restoration in general. Over the last 20 years or so, restoration's sort of become synonymous with the idea of digitizing and then showing a 4K DCP or scanning out, recording out a new negative. But even when you're doing that, you're losing massive amounts of information. The original analog elements have all of this color depth to them, this grayscale depth, this resolution that tends to get diminished or lost. And the bottom line with digital as a tool in restoration is it can be very useful for damaged materials and so forth. It's a very important part of what's done today. But we looked at the printing elements for 2001 and saw that they were in excellent shape. And so we're able to go back to Kubrick's original timing lights of how the color timing should work, put those in, go through the lab and make prints that should be very, very close to the prints that he would have been approving and seeing. And that experience and getting film seen as film is one of the things I'm very passionate about, because particularly for a newer generation of filmmakers, of filmgoers and filmmakers who haven't necessarily got to experience a lot of film projection, I think it's really important. Because that's when you start to understand why people like to shoot on film. Because when you project on film, the difference in medium between celluloid and digital is much more apparent. It's much more extreme.
But this is going to be a singular endeavor, just because the resources just don't exist to do this kind of thing anymore, do they? To take this kind of care and spend this kind of time and allocate these kinds of resources to these assets to render them in the way that you want.
Well, I think the resources are there if the filmmakers are there pushing for it and wanting to do it. I mean, films haven't gotten any cheaper since it went digital. In fact, if anything, they've got more expensive, which is one of the things I take great delight in pointing out to the studio production guys. It's like there aren't any savings there with digital. Or if there are, I don't know where they've gone.
But people will always say that. They say you're saving money. You can shoot. Yeah. You can do more takes. There are things you can look at the daily right away.
Well, there are those. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are unique to digital that some filmmakers respond to and really love, like being able to just run for hours, you know, just run and do all kinds of retakes or whatever.
Although Kubrick did that on film.
But he did. Exactly. He showed you can do it on film if you want to. No, I think the resources are there. I think it's really a question of the drive of the filmmakers and what's important to them. And, you know, the work we're getting from the lab, I mean, these prints that we're getting on 2001, but also the work they did for me last year on Dunkirk.
And how many 70 prints went out of Dunkirk last year?
Well, including our IMAX prints, we did, I think, 138.
That
many? Which
okay.
is a very large number. I mean, even at the height of 65mm acquisition and 70mm distribution, which was really in the 50s and early 60s, I mean, there weren't more than that back then with the roadshow presentations. 70mm then became quite wide in the 80s and early 90s for sound reasons, because pre-digital sound, it was the only way to get six-track sound. So,
you literally have a bigger sound track to work with on the
exactly. But those were blow-ups from 35mm. Not many people were shooting 65, very few, in fact. So now, as I say, with Dunkirk, we were able to put out a very large number of 70mm prints, and a lot of people got to see it that way, which was terrific.
I have to ask what your conversations were like with Kubrick's family when you let them know you get involved in this.
Well, to be honest, it was more through the studio, who have a terrific relationship with Jan Harlan and the family, and Ned Price, who's vice president of restoration at Warner Brothers, is who I deal with on my films, has had a very close relationship with the estate and with the family. And so I worked through them and just consulted, you know, through them, and really just assured everybody that we weren't doing anything interpretive. We weren't doing it. There's nothing of I'm doing this as a fan and as a technician and somebody who can push the studio, engage the studio in a conversation about, let's put the resources behind this to do this right, and let's make sure that it's done in a technically accurate way. And so everything we've done with 2001 is done from an IP. We're not touching the original negative. We're using a printing element that's been made from the original negative, but our tweaks and timings to get it exactly the way that it was supposed to be, they're all done without in any way changing or damaging the original elements, which have to be preserved exactly as is. And it's really remarkable. I mean, as a filmmaker working in 2018, it's humbling, you know, to realize that they had these incredible ways of presenting a film to an audience that was so far beyond a home experience or, you know, a small multiplex experience. And I think, as I said before, I think it's a timely reminder of the potential of the theatrical experience.
Well, at a time, I can't thank you enough for doing this, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest is Christopher Nolan. I'm still awake. He's been responsible for bringing 2001 Space Odyssey back to theaters in 70mm and six channels down the way it belongs. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Josh Harnell. The show is mixed by Kat Yores, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. This show is not an Atmos either. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.